Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right. You're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Of course, we have Tina Martini of McDermott, Will and Emery, and Rich Lenkoff from Downey and Lenkoff. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. Well, former President Donald Trump's criminal trial is underway in New York. Prosecutors are pushing the judge to hold the former president in contempt for violating a gag order. Renato Stabile, an attorney and managing director with Dubin Research and Consulting, where he oversees a team of lawyers, analysts, and graphic designers to construct focus group presentations that test clients' trial themes, demonstrative concepts, and key evidence against what they are likely to face from the other side of the trial. He joins us. He gives us quite an interesting perspective as we dive deeper into this Trump trial.
Renato, welcome. You're an expert, as Ryan mentioned, in the science. Some might say it's an art of picking a jury. In this case, as Ryan mentioned, the former president has not been shy about violating, we think, a gag order. And he's speaking directly about jurors, calling them mostly Democrat and unfair. How difficult does that make it to be, you know, to find jurors that are willing to serve and to keep them engaged when they hear the president, the ex-president, talking this way?
Well, it makes it very difficult. Look, he's right. It is a mostly Democratic jurisdiction in Manhattan. I think it's like 88% registered Democrats. So he faces an uphill battle. But, you know, the thing is, you don't want jurors to feel like they're being intimidated in any way. And I don't mean directly by him. It's the concern that he's sending some message out to his supporters, and that if they make a decision that's adverse to him, that there are going to be some sort of repercussions.
So, Renato, what do you make of the judge's rather unusual practice of asking prospective jurors to raise their hands if they felt they couldn't be fair or impartial, which resulted in excusing a large number of potential jurors without further questioning?
You know, so it's interesting. First of all, that's highly unusual in any case to just let people self-select. I mean, you could have sent a note out with the jury summons saying, if you don't feel like coming, just don't come. So that in itself is highly unusual. I think Donald Trump yesterday was complaining about how quickly the process went, but apparently, you know, both sides consented to that procedure. And people have asked me, well, does that benefit the prosecution or the defense? I don't know that it benefits anybody, because anybody who doesn't want to be there just isn't going to be there. You know, you can think about it in some ways, people that you know, would be bad for him might self-select out, but people who might be good for him might self-select out. And what I mean by that is, you know, you tend to think that the more conservative people in Manhattan are going to be in a wealthier demographic. And maybe some of them, when given the opportunity, just said, you know what, I don't have time for this. See you later. I'm just going to go on with my life. So it could have hurt both sides.
Now, Renato, I pick juries also, and it never really comes up in my trials because they're not these kind of trials, but, you know, this whole allegation that people are lying about their proclivities, about their background, about the media they follow, about whether they like Trump or they don't. This whole idea that liberals lied their way to get on and maybe conservatives lied their way to get on. Again, it's not something the average jury, you know, or trial lawyer deals with. What do you make of that allegation? I think Trump retweeted a Jesse Waters allegation about that the other day. Does that happen? And how, as a jury consultant, how, as a litigant, do you avoid that kind of thing? I mean, there's really, at the end of the day, no way to know if someone's lying, right? Except the fact that they're under the penalty of perjury.
Yeah. So look, it doesn't happen in the typical trial. You're right. But in these ultra high profile trials, it certainly does happen. But I don't think liberals or conservatives have a monopoly, you know, on lying to get onto the jury. It could go either way. It's just the fact of the matter is Manhattan is heavily Democratic. So you have to be concerned that people are getting on with an agenda. You also have to be concerned about the timing of this trial. You know, everybody there's an election coming up. So people might be going into this thinking there are real repercussions to my decision beyond just guilt or innocence. So you have to watch out for that. And the way you kind of figure out if people are lying is today we can go on social media. So if people are saying things that are inconsistent with what we see them posting or comments that they've made online, you can sort of root that out.
So Renato, conventional wisdom is that lawyers never make it on juries. But I've just been seeing it a lot more just among people I know who are lawyers, including lawyers becoming foremen of the juries. And there are two lawyers here among the 12 jurors that have been impaneled. Why is that?
Super risky move. I almost never recommend taking lawyers because unless you're really sure about that they're going to be with you, you're taking a gigantic risk that they're going to lead the jury against you. I think the thinking here was it was a bold move, and there are some very complex legal issues. And I think the complexity actually got ramped up in the opening statements where the prosecution is now floating this New York election law sort of legal theory. And I think what the defense might be thinking is, look, we want lawyers on there who might say, look, this is not making sense legally to us, and kind of steer jurors in that direction. But obviously the prosecutors didn't strike them either. So the prosecutors think they're good for them. But keep in mind, one thing that we don't know that the parties do know, they know the political affiliation. They know the political registration of these jurors. They know their names. We don't know their names. So it's very possible that they know something we just don't.
Renato, we like to ask guests on this show to take us in the room where it happens, take us behind the scenes. We know that you were not engaged in this particular case for your services, but you've worked on hundreds, thousands of high-profile cases over your illustrious career. What happens when you go into a room with a client, maybe not as high-profile as Trump, but high-profile, and you're going over your plan to deal with voir dire? What kind of things are you telling? What kind of things are you advising your clients? Give us a little bit of insight into what your job entails, especially when it comes to high profile cases.
Look, in any jury selection, high profile or not, you go in with a deselection profile. It is not jury selection. It is jury deselection because you have no control over who stays on the jury. Because if the other side is doing their job, they're going to strike your best jurors. So you have to go in with the mindset of who are the people we absolutely can't live with and impress that upon the client. But look, hopefully the client is going to defer to the decisions of his lawyers or his jury consultants or whoever. But ultimately, it's his life. It's his future. And, you know, sometimes you have to defer to the client if they have a strong feeling. I don't know how involved Donald Trump was in the jury selection. I mean, I know he was paying attention, but the reports I've gotten, I wasn't in the courtroom. It didn't seem like he was overly involved in that aspect of the case. I'm sure he's involved in a lot of other aspects. But, you know, it's a balancing.
Renato, if you were hired in this case and you were in that courtroom, what kind of things would you be looking for every day as signs from the jury as to whether they're paying attention, whether they're engaged, perhaps, you know, they're favoring one side or the other? What are some of the tips that you use in your expertise that helps you advise your clients how the trial is going?
The number one tip I would say is you absolutely cannot read juries just based on looking at them. You just can't. I've been in the situation, and any trial lawyer has been in the situation, jurors will nod at you, smile at you, take notes when you speak and not take notes when the prosecution speaks. And you think that that's some sort of sign, and then it goes totally opposite. I am not a believer in reading facial expressions, body language. You just don't know. Look, it's important that you don't want to alienate the jury. You have to be personable, obviously likable. But I think, you know, once they're sat in that jury box, hopefully you've done enough. And I think in this trial, it's going to be very tough for him to get an acquittal. I think his lawyers probably know that, and they're going for the hung jury here. So they're just hoping that one or two of these people are going to hang tough and, you know, vote not guilty.
Renato, last question here on Legal Faceoff. Based on the relatively brisk pace that we've seen, you know, people thought it would take weeks to get a jury. It took a week. What's your prediction as to when we will see a decision, either a verdict or something else?
I think the trial after this week maybe goes two more weeks. I don't see how this is going 5 weeks. You know, I think it was slated for 6 weeks overall. You had 1 week of jury selection, then 5 more weeks of testimony. I just don't see that.
And the interesting thing is this takes him off of the campaign trail quite a bit. He was supposed to have a rally in North Carolina this weekend. It got washed out. He says he's going to go back. But, you know, this is obviously a prime time for him to get on the campaign trail. Mr. Sabeel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and leading lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off with Rich Lenkoff and Tina Martini. I'm Ryan Burrow. We get to talk a little baseball today. Shohei Ohtani, probably the biggest name in baseball right now, has been dealing with a scandal involving his interpreter and longtime friend. To break this down, Andrew Brandt joins us on Legal Face-Off. He's a sports commentator and professor of the Morehead Center for the Study of Sports Law at Villanova University. Mr. Brandt, you've got a Packers helmet behind you, but we won't hold that against you. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, sorry about that. 10 years in Green Bay, so I'm impressed that you had me on anyway. But it's been quite a time. I mean, there's been no area of sports law, sports business, sports policy that has undergone a big change as sports betting. I remember back in the day with the Packers, I even tried to have a fantasy football draft where a bunch of us coaches and administrators and front office were sitting around one day. And we're like, yeah, let's have a draft right before the season. And we had two rules, no Packers and no money. And I said, all right, sounds good, but I better call the league. And they're like, Andrew, don't call the league. Like, I'll call the league. I'm a lawyer. I need to call the league. So I call, and I swear to God, this is like 2009. He says to me, I say, we're going to do a draft, no money, no Packers. Are we cool? And he says, we didn't have this conversation. Ooh. So that's 15 years ago, how much we've changed. I mean, the NFL banned Tony Romo from going to a fantasy football conference. It's just amazing that it's now embedded in all our sports viewing, our sports programming, our sports sponsorships. It's amazing.
So perhaps to that point, that makes people like Shohei more, maybe he's putting his guard down more, and maybe his allegation that he was not aware of any of these $16 million in bets that was placed on his interpreter's behalf. Maybe his denial of knowing about that is hard to believe. What do you think? Do we believe him?
You know, I agree with you that it's hard to believe, but I am starting to come around that he was completely 100% duped. This is hard to fathom when we talk about bank account codes and when we talk about guardrails that banks put up for huge transfers of money. But the federal complaint really believed Ohtani. And my sense is the MLB investigation may do the same, which is that this interpreter who befriended him 6 years ago in Anaheim has totally duped him, has duped all the codes and the passwords for the bank and the routing and all that. And Ohtani just really was clueless. I guess what I'm saying is I find it hard to believe, but it seems like that's becoming more the case. That's what the feds are believing. And I think that may be what baseball believes.
You raise a really interesting point, Professor, which I want to follow up on. You know, you've been involved in these investigations, not this exact thing, but many investigations involving teams and players over the years. The feds did their investigation. That resulted in them not charging Shohei. Does the MLB investigators, are they perhaps more stringent? Might they find something the feds didn't find? What's the difference between those two kinds of investigations, if any?
Well, the difference is what they're looking for, because if I could take it to football, I was around for, say, the Ray Rice investigation. Ray Rice, who beat up his then-girlfriend, now wife, didn't have any criminal proceeding. He was sentenced to pretrial diversion and counseling and all that. But the NFL has its own domestic violence policy. And of course, he was banned for life. I'm sorry, indefinite suspension. Now, when we get to Ohtani, baseball has its own rules, which we can talk about in a minute, which are probably different than the feds. The feds are looking for a criminal act, which they found with Mitsuhara, the interpreter. So, it is a different investigation. And now we can talk, if you want, about sort of the MLB rules about betting.
Yeah, Professor, you're reading our minds. So the Major League Baseball policy prohibits employees from gambling on baseball, right? But they're allowed to legally gamble on other sports, as the interpreter Mitsuhara claimed he did.
Right.
Say for the moment that Ohtani was in fact involved in the gambling, but on another sport, what kind of exposure would he face?
You know, two parts to that. MLB Rule 21D, which basically says you can gamble on other sports besides baseball. But the word I left out, the key word in that, is legally gamble. So now we have this other factor with Ohtani, because as we sit here today in April 2024, there are 38 states with legalized gambling, plus the District of Columbia. That list does not, I repeat, does not include California. So even if he's betting safely on horse racing or European soccer, it's not legal. He's doing it, as we know from the complaint, with an illegal bookmaker. And this illegal bookmaker is now under the subject of investigation as well. So this is not good. So if Christina, we do surmise that somehow, some way, Ohtani did know, that's a big problem. Because not that he was betting on other sports, but that he was doing it illegally.
Professor, you started this segment by discussing how times have changed, how gambling is now so integral to professional sports. And that's just over the last few years. We saw last week that the NBA imposed a lifetime ban on Toronto Raptor Jontae Porter, who was found to have conspired with bettors to cash in on wagers, predicting that he would perform poorly in certain games. I use also an associate's account to gamble on games. Is it possible, in light of these two scandals, for sports and gambling to coexist, especially when we consider how much money the leagues are now making off gambling?
Well, you picked up the key thing. Now, as a sports lawyer, as a professor, I followed with great detail the lawsuit that was 7 years in the making by New Jersey, again, trying to legalize sports betting, right? And NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball, NCAA, NHL fought it to the teeth. 7 years, tens of millions of dollars of legal fees because it was against the integrity of the game. All of a sudden, against every legal expert's opinion, the Supreme Court took the case. And now we get to May of 2018, the Supreme Court ruled that New Jersey can, in fact, implement sports betting. And the NFL, NBA, and NCAA, Major League Baseball lose the case. But I wondered at the time, did they win by losing? Because now they've unlocked hundreds of millions, eventually billions of dollars, as you said, of monetization about sports betting. And as everyone listening knows, you can't turn on a sporting event without being bombarded by DraftKings, FanDuel. And full disclosure, my podcast, The Business of Sports, sponsored by DraftKings. Every sports podcast is sponsored by one of those. It's just everywhere. So I think what we're getting around to is the mantra from leagues right now is to players, do as I say, not as I do. So when we get down to it with sports betting right now, leagues can embrace it. Teams can embrace it. Players still can't, at least on their sport. And some leagues are a little looser than others on that. But it really is a two-edged sword. Now, to excuse Ohtani or all these players that have been suspended by the NFL, I don't know. I mean, they should know, right? I mean, we can't excuse them to say, well, it's on the commercials. Everyone's doing it. We have the DraftKings. I don't know. You know, we can all judge whether that would be a plausible excuse to go bet.
I just want to say Ohtani's actually been getting Astro-style booing. I don't know if you guys have noticed some of these games that he's had. Ironically, from fans who probably spent a lot of money to see him in these games. So, Mr. Brandt, thank you so much for joining us on Legal Faceoff.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to the Legal Faceoff podcast on social media and WGNradio.com. Well, it was a bit of a surprise when we learned O.J. Simpson died at the age of 76. Many of us didn't even know he was sick, but of course, his death rehashed all those emotions and memories we had with his high-profile murder trial in the 90s. And we're fortunate enough to have world-renowned attorney Gloria Allred on with us today. You may remember she represented Nicole Brown Simpson during that trial, which for most of us played out like a made-for-TV movie at the time. Ms. Allred, thank you so much for joining us on Legal Faceoff.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Gloria, it's always such an honor to have you join us, so thank you. As Ryan mentioned, earlier this month, O.J. Simpson died of cancer at the age of 76. You represented Nicole Brown Simpson's family. OJ was on trial for Nicole's 1994 brutal murder, along with her friend's murder, Ron Goldman. What were your immediate thoughts when you heard the news of OJ's death?
Well, it brought back memories of what was going on in the 90s when, in fact, he faced the murder charges in a criminal trial and later wrongful death allegations in a civil trial. Of course, Mr. Simpson, defendant Simpson, convicted felon Simpson, was acquitted in the criminal case. Having said that, some people who remember the criminal case forget that following that acquittal, there was a civil lawsuit brought by the estate of Nicole Brown Simpson and the estate of Ronald Goldman. May he rest in peace and may she rest in peace. And that as a result of that case, Mr. Simpson was found in the civil case to be liable for the wrongful death of Nicole and Ron. That is important, because that means that that case found that less evidence was required, of course, in a civil case, just a preponderance of the evidence, or for punitive damages, clear and convincing evidence. But that jury did find that he was responsible for the death of those two innocent human beings. And I think that's important. Now, some people say, well, how could a different jury find a different result? Well, beside the fact that in a civil case, less evidence is required because we're seeing, you know, those who are plaintiffs are seeking compensation, not the loss of liberty of the defendant. In the civil case, Mr. Simpson was required to testify, and he did testify. And the reason he was required to testify, even though he was allowed to remain silent in the criminal case, could not be compelled to testify in a criminal case, is because he was acquitted in the criminal case, therefore double jeopardy attached, meaning he could not be re-prosecuted in a criminal case. Therefore, he was required to testify in the civil case, and clearly the jury didn't believe him. Didn't believe him when he sat on the witness stand and testified under oath, sitting next to a large photograph of Nicole Brown Simpson with a black eye that he had inflicted on her 5 years prior to killing her. And he was denying any violence against her. The jury didn't believe him, and therefore he was found to be liable for wrongful death. So anyway, that's kind of a long way of describing why I don't shed any tears for the death of O.J. Simpson, who killed two human beings.
Lori, in addition to that famous, very unfortunate photo of one of the victims of O.J. Simpson, we all heard at the time, and again last week, the famous 911 tapes where Nicole Brown Simpson was pleading with police to help her. And she said very famously, you know who this is, you know his track record. And that was ignored by the police. You've been one of the foremost champions, not only women's rights, but of victims of sexual abuse, victims of domestic violence over many, many decades. What message did this case send to victims of domestic abuse? And how has that changed over the last several years? Again, thanks to people like you who have taken up these causes.
Well, such an important question, Rich. And that call was part of the 1989 case brought against O.J. Simpson 5 years before the killing of Nicole, when we heard her beg for protection from the police. What happened was he not only beat her and gave her a black eye, she ran from the home and hid terrified in the bushes outside to get away from O.J. Simpson. He was prosecuted, but here's what happened. He was prosecuted for spousal violence against her. He entered a plea of no contest, meaning he admitted to it, but the judge did not give him 1 year, 1 month, or even 1 day or 1 second in custody of law enforcement. He was able to plead and get some form of community service instead. And there is even a question remaining today as to whether he even completed the community service to which he was sentenced after he entered the plea of no contest. Bottom line is this: when a defendant commits an act of spousal violence or violence against their significant other and does not pay any significant consequences for that gender violence, of course, he's going to be emboldened. He's going to feel empowered to continue to inflict violence and even more extreme violence on the victim. And that, in fact, is what happened in the case of O.J. Simpson and Nicole Brown Simpson. She left him. She moved away with the children, also in L.A., but still away. But he went and committed the ultimate act of violence, killing her. And I say that is something we need to remember, even today, 30 years after the killing, that, you know, there are still problems with battered women getting the kind of justice that they so richly deserve to get. And there are still not adequate consequences on perpetrators of violence against women.
Gloria, the O.J. Simpson trial, in addition to what you so eloquently just shared with us, it was historic in a number of ways and has had a lasting impact on our criminal justice system, including, for example, how police investigations are conducted and how murder cases are tried. In addition to what you just shared with us about how the system failed Nicole Brown Simpson and battered women everywhere, what do you think were some of the other profound lessons coming out of the O.J. Simpson murder trial?
Well, what happened in the O.J. Simpson murder trial was that the defense presented a narrative that this case was about race, that this case was being brought against O.J. Simpson, a rich, powerful, influential, and well-loved television and movie and sports personality, just simply because he was an African-American man. The prosecution tried to explain that, A, they had a mountain of evidence against Mr. Simpson with his DNA, his blood at the scene, at the crime scene and elsewhere, and that this was a violence against a woman kind of case. That narrative was kind of treated as a footnote, was my feeling, by the jury. And the main narrative presented by the defense was the winning narrative. And I understand why at that time a lot of African Americans felt that way. But There was a lot of racial turmoil at the time, but it had nothing to do with O.J. Simpson killing Nicole and Ron. And so when spousal violence is treated as though it just doesn't really matter, it just kind of a factor, not the factor. Of course, a jury, is going to be perhaps not treating it as seriously as many people felt that they should. Also, when I heard Johnny Cochran do the closing argument and talk about keep your eyes on the prize to the jury, as a civil rights attorney myself, I knew then that that was a call for the jury to consider racial equity more than they should consider gender violence. I've represented many victims of racial discrimination over the years, still do in many cases, but this was not a case where the law enforcement was bringing this case, to bring down a rich, powerful, famous African-American man. That just wasn't it. But I knew that there was going to be a problem, especially when I heard his closing argument.
Well, and for our Chicago listeners, I want to point out Ron Goldman was a Stevenson High School grad, went to Illinois State. So there are some local ties there as well. Gloria Allred, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. We're looking forward to justice for women. We're not going to rest until we win it. Thank you.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Face-Off. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Tina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Tina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crane's Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Tina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Tina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN. It's time for the Legal Grab Bag. We have the pleasure of being joined by Steve Borgstrom, owner at Employers Claims Services, Inc. Thanks for jumping on with us, Mr. Borgstrom.
Thank you for having me.
And we have Ruth Rosinski, the claims manager at Coca-Cola Florida. Ms. Rosinski, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
Well, we touched on this earlier. Former President Donald Trump's criminal trial is underway in Manhattan. 12 New York jurors are going to decide the fate of the former president, which could derail his political aspirations or maybe even propel him to the White House. Rich, what have you made of the proceedings to this point?
Well, the opening statements were interesting. I mean, I think they were pretty direct. We saw the discussion yesterday about whether he violated the ban. That's still to be determined. The judge was pretty critical of him and his lawyers. David Pecker has testified. He is the former publisher of the National Enquirer. He is central to the allegation of the prosecutors that Trump was engaged in this catch and kill scheme involving Stormy Daniels and others. So, Trump is coming out every day and giving his perspective. We know what his perspective is. It's that this is a politically motivated prosecution and that he cannot get a fair trial in Manhattan. But so far the trial seems to be moving at a pretty brisk pace. Our earlier guest predicted that we will see a verdict in another 2 or 3 weeks, which would be a pretty, pretty strong pace. Tina, what are your thoughts so far?
I agree with what you've said. It's going to be interesting. We talked with our guest earlier about the potential perils of having a couple of lawyers on the jury. And clearly, I think what the best result would be for Trump and his lawyers at this point would be trying to get a hung jury. It's going to be interesting watching the journey to get to a decision, Rich, because every day is filled with interesting, somewhat predictable things, but there's always a curveball coming. So
there's some concern about what Trump is saying, violating the gag order. The prosecutors have asked for so far only $1,000 a day fine, but it is possible to throw Trump in jail for contempt of court if he violates the gag order. By some accounts, the Secret Service has already been talking to the prison staff about how that would work logistically. Ruth, what are your thoughts so far on what you've seen? Do you think that this jury is composed of people who can put aside their predisposed notions of what they think about Trump and rule evidence that's presented, which, of course, they all assert? You know, everyone says that when you are going into a trial during voir dire, you never know whether they're going to do that or not. You're relying on these 12 people to be honest when they say we're only going to judge things based on the evidence. When it comes to Trump, it's impossible not to have some feelings in advance. So do you think he'll get a fair shake?
Yeah, every time I think about this case and Trump case, the one thing that comes to mind is always, what is really the crime? You know, the question in my mind is, what are the charges here really based on just election interference? So, I think Trump is the presumptive GOP nominee. His prime example, I think, is turning obstacle into a winning strategy. I think this is all being noise to the Democrats that have created this only to serve a bolster for Trump's win. They did it in 2016. And I think that, you know, now in 2024, we're kind of seeing the historical reoccurrence again. So I think it's going to be interesting to play now. I mean, obviously, this is the first time that we have seen this type of trial case to take based on a former president. So who knows what's really going to happen. But one of the things that really came out to my head that stand out based on the defense opening statement is to let the jurors know, use your common sense. But the first thing in my mind is question number one, well, what's really the election interference? The Democrats, I think that they have come to a point where they, in my opinion, that, you know, trying to strategize the upset at the momentum that Trump has gained. And he continues to be out there and going to bodegas and going to all these different places in New York to try to put him and still tweeting, you know. So that's something about him that I think that is admirable in a way, although I'm definitely not a Trump person per se, but he's definitely a business guy. He's definitely a businessman. He strategized. He knows what he says and what he thinks. And I think the Democrats continue to push that bolster on bringing all these different noises to the table.
Well, moving along to another topic here, pro-Palestinian demonstrations have been taking place at universities, including Columbia, Cornell, Michigan, handful of others. Some have become violent. Some have led to acts of anti-Semitism. Some have led to arrest. The House Speaker is actually going to Columbia today. Tina, unrest at college campuses is not new. This has a little different feel, though.
Yeah, Ryan. So it's been over 6 months since the Israel-Hamas war began, and tensions, as you mentioned, continue to rise on college campuses across the country. Protests calling for the divestment of college and university funds from Israeli military operations have continued to spread at many schools, including Yale, NYU, Harvard, MIT, and Tufts on the East Coast, and also on the West Coast. Some of the student protests have turned into encampments and have led to hundreds of arrests. Following the suspension, arrests, and student removals of more than 100 protesters, for example, last week at Columbia, the school has now opted to go remote with their classes for the remainder of the semester. While school administrators claim that the protests on campuses have been largely peaceful, some students have said that the on-campus tension has created concerns about safety, which has led to things like the remote or hybrid learning options. Just by way of example, at Yale over the past week, hundreds of student protesters have been protesting and advocating for Yale's divestment from military weapons manufacturers. The university, as other universities, has policies against occupying outdoor spaces and has used this as a basis to warn students about law enforcement coming in and leading to reprimand, probation, or suspension to clear the space. On Monday morning, almost 50 Yale students were removed and arrested. At NYMU, more than 150 people were arrested on Monday night. The story is very similar to what happened at Yale, where there's a plaza at NYU in the Manhattan campus where folks are not allowed to occupy the space and were asked to leave based on the violation of safety protocols. And officials claim that some of the behavior among protesters became violent. At Harvard, school officials have suspended the Harvard-Palestine Solidarity Committee, with the group saying in a statement that it has faced unprecedented repression and that Harvard has now decided to dismantle the only official student group that is dedicated to the task of representing the Palestinian cause. On the West Coast, Cal Poly Humboldt students are occupying a campus building where dozens of students have barricaded themselves on campus, with the campus locking down on Monday. It's going to remain closed through today, Rich. So, I mean, we could spend a lot of time talking about all the unrest across the country. I know you've got a college daughter. How are things with her and her friends?
Well, I mean, the question is just for our purposes, like, you know, from a legal perspective, what's the law? So, I mean, you know, it's crazy that these groups, many of whom are not students, they're outsiders taking advantage, coming onto campus. You know, these are mostly private institutions. But they're mostly NYU. These are private institutions that have the right to trespass people off their property if they're not invited there. That needs to be done. There's far too much willingness to allow these, in many cases, non-students to come on and not just, you know, protest, but conduct violent behavior. So it's ridiculous. If the schools aren't going to do it, the state, the city should come in en masse, if they have on some occasions, but not enough, and get rid of these people and let students go to school. You ask about my daughter, we're paying, you know, a lot of money, as are Columbia, as are, you know, Yale parents and students to go to school there, not to go remotely. So it's nuts that every day that you can't go to school and be on campus. The second thing, you know, the president of Columbia, Steve, was in front of Congress last week. And you know, here's some advice. If you're a university president and you find yourself in front of a microphone in front of Congress, resign on the spot. That's never gone well. That image of you testifying in front of Congress as a university president, when has that gone well? I mean, there's already, you know, millions of people calling for her resignation after her appearance. We saw the Harvard president resign, a couple others a few months ago. If you're getting that subpoena, just resign. Save yourself the trip and the embarrassment. Steve, what do you make of all this?
I think it's terrible. I think it's kind of a bandwagon. I'm not sure how many people truly believe what they are protesting about. And I don't think, you know, they do have a right. But like you said, if they're not students, I totally agree with you that they should be escorted off the property.
Ruth, what's your take on this?
I definitely agree. I think that I don't understand, I guess, that we allow in this type of behavior. And some of the things I mentioned, Rich, is, you know, these are big top university for the United States. So it's an overall conspiracy that we're making from starting in big colleges like this, that we're allowing people to do this. It's sad. And, you know, it takes more than just, you know, freedom of speech. Is not just a form of freedom of speech, is the way that we're doing it, the way that we're reminding our ancestors, the way we're reminding our children how to properly debate and be intelligent in some disagreement, because that's always going to happen now and when you're in the workforce as well.
Moving along, the president this morning signed a TikTok ban Well, it's not really a ban as long as the Chinese company ByteDance divests over the next year. 170 million people use it to create dance moves and various other things every day. Rich, why does Congress hate everything young people like?
Where's Ryan going to go for his TikTok content from now on? I mean, that's how you get all of your pop culture and dance moves. And
absolutely. And some of our news, too. Yeah.
Markstrom's a big TikToker. Yeah, I mean, listen, this has been, you know, this is not a new phenomenon. Former President Trump threatened to ban TikTok. And again, it's not a ban as much as a order for them within a year to find a buyer, a domestic buyer. Of course, the allegation is that TikTok is merely a tool of the Chinese government used to collect data from people outside of China, including Americans. So there seems to be widespread support. I mean, this is one example where there is bipartisan support for it. You know, some more liberal members of Congress are in favor of keeping it. Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably, you know, the flip side, of course, is that this is an example of free expression, that this is a First Amendment issue. TikTok has vowed to fight this in court, argue that they are an independent entity. They and their users should be allowed to express themselves consistent with the First Amendment.
Yeah, Rich, I don't really agree that by banning TikTok that this would necessarily be some sort of suppression of freedom of speech. I think there are other avenues by which people could continue to express themselves, especially when unbalanced the determination's being made that there's a worse threat posed by, you know, gathering data, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, it's going to be interesting to see what ends up happening here. We've been following this story for a while. Obviously, there are a ton of TikTok users, but I have a hard time believing that there isn't another mechanism by which people could end up expressing themselves in a comparable way. So,
Ruth, we picture TikTok users as, you know, teenagers, you know, sharing dance moves and talking about the latest film or pop culture or Taylor Swift. But there are millions and millions of businesses that rely on TikTok, right? Small businesses that rely on TikTok. Might this have a detrimental effect on them and therefore be, you know, a huge detriment to the economy?
I mean, I agree to that extent. I think, you know, the TikTok, I think the economic per se might be a challenge in the long run, because you do, even small, you know, influencer, that's where they get a lot of their salary and their cost of living, per se. I do have a teenager daughter. She's 15, so she's in that cutteration of Gen X, which is the TikTok most of people are using. She's not allowed to have TikTok. And for my personal reason as a parent, is the challenges that they see, you know, a lot of those blackout challenge, the Tide podcast challenge, arise from the TikTok challenges and the dancing and seeing and interacting with, oh, well, let's do this. So I'm not allowed, my child is not allowed to have TikTok in the house. I think that social media essentially have changed with Connect, really focusing on socializing and connecting and interacting with other people. So you have this young mind thinking of, you know, feeling certain way about their body shaming or the way that they perceive the world or materialistic things, and now challenges that, you know, they perceive in a day to day. So I'm all for the ban or selling it.
Well, interesting. Steve, there's been literally no evidence supplied, at least publicly, by the government in this country that TikTok is sharing our data with the Chinese government. We are an evidence-based country. We are, you know, a democracy. We are a free market. Isn't this ban a little extreme without that kind of evidence?
Yes, I agree. It comes down to parenting. If you don't want your kids watching TikTok, you can block it on your phone. You know, if this ban does go into effect, where does it stop? That's what scares me. You know, again, we have the, you know, if there can be some regulation, fine. But I like the freedom, you know.
But Rich, would we ever see evidence? I mean, I guess that is the question in my mind. If there's evidence, I don't think it's necessarily going to be publicized.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, but, you know, just going on this assumption that the Chinese government is involved without actual evidence, I think, you know, given the amount of people that are using TikTok for personal and business use, and also given that it is an expression that a whole generation of people are using, it's a little hard to just, you know, say, trust me, or, you know, just go with the trust me. It's bad.
Well, I mean, TikTok is owned by ByteDance, so that's a Chinese company. So.
And to add to all of this, it was all wrapped into the foreign aid bill that the president just signed. So kind of interesting. Nobody's taken away my MySpace account, though. That's still up and running. The federal.
Does everybody actually use that already? Or I think people stopped using MySpace.
Oh, really? I was wondering where all my friends went. All right, moving along, the Federal Trade Commission this week voted to ban nearly all non-competes. These are agreements employers make with employees, preventing them from walking across the street, as we put it, for competing businesses or launching their own. Tina, this is a pretty big deal for the private sector.
Yeah, Ryan. So there's an estimated 30 million people who are bound by or impacted by non-competes nationwide, who are really impacted by this ruling that essentially bans nearly all non-competes. It's not all non-competes, as I'll get to in a second. This highly controversial decision is set to take effect later this year and garnered many thousands of public comments, which led up to this vote, with some compelling arguments on both sides of the debate. On the pro-employee side, there are stories of, for example, people being stuck in abusive workplaces and not being able to leave their jobs, with claims of being robbed of economic liberty and not being able to find other jobs, for example, where they were able to more freely engage in religious practices. On the other side of the debate, non-competes can be incredibly important to employers, particularly those that are heavily invested in intellectual property. Non-competes enable those companies to better guard their trade secrets, and gives employers more of an incentive to invest in workforce training and development, which ultimately inures to the benefit of employees as well. The FTC claims that this policy change could lead to increased wages totaling nearly $300 billion a year by encouraging employee mobility. The exception that I mentioned a couple of minutes ago that's been carved out for existing non-competes is for companies that have given non-competes to senior executives on the basis that these agreements for that demographic are more likely to have been negotiated. There's a full expectation, Rich, that this ban is going to be challenged in court, with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce coming out right away saying that they would sue the FTC to block the rule.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be an overreach, in my opinion. You know, let the free market govern. Businesses should be allowed to put this kind of language into their agreements, and employees should be able to negotiate out of it if they want to, right? It speaks to the idea that read what you sign before you sign it. If you don't want a non-compete, then don't take the job. You know, the economy is rolling along pretty well. Unemployment is low. Lots of jobs out there. I see the benefit to not having someone be with your company for 6 months and then steal your trade secrets, steal your, you know, customer list, and then go to a competitor. That's been, you know, integral to our system for many years. So I think this is government overreach. I don't think it'll be held up. And of course, depending on the results of the presidential election, this might not be an issue come the fall. But Steve, where do you come down on this issue?
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, Rich, but no, how come lawyers, they can practice law anywhere. So they don't have any non-competes, correct?
Lawyers can't sign a non-compete or enforce one because it's not ethical to have your clients be beholden to one attorney. In other words, you know, clients are allowed to go wherever they want. If I had a non-compete, my clients would have to stay with my employer. That is contrary to the rules of ethics. So that's not enforceable for attorneys. But it's, of course, enforceable in most other areas. At least it was before this ban. But yeah, we'll see what happens. We'll see if it holds up in court, Ryan.
Yeah, O.J. Simpson's will has been filed, and he set some pretty strict parameters on where his money will go. Rich, you toss this one into the grab bag for us.
Well, we talked to Gloria Allred earlier, and she represented some of the family members of his victims, the Goldmans. And of course, you know, very famously for the last 30 years, the Goldmans have been trying to recover some of the $100 million judgment that O.J. Simpson owes the family. He has, you know, been adamant, or he was adamant when he was alive, that he would never pay it, that the Goldman family would not see a penny. And apparently, his wishes are continuing in his death, Tina, because his executor has said he will do everything to ensure that the family gets zero from the estate. Not quite clear why, but this continues. It's disgusting. I mean, we've had some of the Goldmans on our show before. It's disgusting that O.J. Simpson was able to avoid the repercussions of his act, which a jury found him civilly liable in the death of these people. He was able to elude that forever, play golf. You know, he was probably looking for the killer of his ex-wife on the golf course because that's what he said he would do. But this continues in his death. Pretty unfortunate.
Yeah, Rich, I think I saw a pretty current headline that the executor is now done an about face. I think he's actually seen the light and said that he's not going to stand in the way, which I thought was really kind of strange that, you know, he came out pretty strong at the beginning, as you noted, and now he's done an about face and said that he's going to cooperate with the Goldman family. So, we'll see. But always drama around O.J. Simpson, that's for sure, even after he's died.
Ruth, is this the end of it? Ruth, Steve, what do you guys think? Is this the end of the O.J. Saga, or will there be one more effort to get some of his money? I mean, he didn't have a lot of money at the end of his life, but, I don't know.
I think they should get anything they're entitled to under the law. I mean, and I think that's probably why there was a change of mind of the executor. They should get it.
Yeah.
Anything that they can get.
There's a civil judgment. I mean, that has been adjudicated. So he just hasn't paid. He's been able to elude that for many years. Ruth, what's your take on it?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, he was found liable in the civil court. So I don't think the Goldman's family will stop just obtaining that money. I mean, and it's true. I think they say that they're wanting to not more about the money, but they wanted to hold him accountable. So just based on the civil court of civil procedure, he should just go ahead and pay it. I don't think the Goldman family are just going to, we don't get any money. It's okay. I think they're definitely going to fight it.
Well, moving along, we've all heard of shrinkflation, smaller cookies, smaller bags, fewer chips. Now the movie theater chain Cinemark is being sued for allegedly shortchanging moviegoers on their cups of soda, or I call it pop. Tina, you brought this one up.
Yeah, Ryan. So there's a proposed class action that was recently filed in Texas against Cinemark with allegations that it's been misleading consumers regarding its largest beverage container and claims that its tactics are part of its systemic packaging and pricing practice, with allegations of negligent misrepresentation, fraud, and unjust enrichment. The lawsuit claims specifically that Cinemark's 24-ounce cups aren't actually 24 ounces and can only be filled with a maximum of 22 ounces of liquid. The lawsuit alleges that consumers believe they're getting a better deal by buying the largest beverage container, but that they're actually getting more volume when they buy the 20-ounce cup. One of the lead plaintiffs, being the astute individual he is, says that he suspected the large cup was not large enough to actually hold 24 ounces and confirmed it when he took the container home, did his little experiment, and found that only 22 ounces of liquid could be held. So, Rich, we've covered a lot of stories like this on Legal Face Off. I mean, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, obviously, it's very fact specific, but if the cup is supposedly 24 ounces and only 22 ounces, that doesn't necessarily bode well for Cinemark.
I guess. I mean, another dumb lawsuit. Dumb, useless lawsuit of a guy who, imagine taking a cup home for the movies and
running an experiment.
how sad your life is that you've got, that's what you're doing. Just live with it. Just please move on. Steve, like many of these cases, and Ruth, well, we're going to go to Steve on this one. It's shocking that even if you think that you can prove liability, what are the damages, right? We talk about damages. You and I have cases where we talk about damages. What would be the damages to an individual who didn't get that extra ounce of soda or beer?
I don't know. And again, if isn't it when a lawyer has a class action, isn't that like a jackpot? Lotto winning?
You know who is the jackpot for? The lawyers.
Or the lawyer. Yeah, exactly. And again, especially with the beverage business, if you have more ice, you're going to have less fluid ounces in there. So if you put in less ice, you're going to have more fluid. So what are they going to do? How are they going to measure this? It's totally ridiculous.
You raise a great point, because I want to start a class action against every restaurant that refuses to give me ice. What is up with not getting ice and water? Ice? Is there a shortage of ice, Ryan Burrow? I want ice. You can't have water with no ice. What am I, 97, where I want a nice warm glass of water with my meal? Please.
I mean, the man could be making argument that he was dehydrated. He lost out on those 4 ounces, I suppose. Dehydration is a big issue. Country singer Luke Bryan took a spill at his concert, threatened to get his lawyer involved. I think this guy was kidding, Rich. I don't know if you've seen the video or not, but
Everyone's seen the video. He was walking across stage at a concert in Vancouver. He slips and falls, looks down. It turns out to be a fan cell phone that he slipped on. Says, you know, I'm calling my lawyer. So that's kind of funny. What is not that funny, and we're seeing a lot of, Tina, is like people throwing stuff on stage during concerts. When did this happen? When did this become, like, do you think you're going to endear yourself to the artist by throwing a cell phone at their face? We saw Bebe Rexha injured. She had a black eye. We saw, Cardi B? She threw a microphone back after she was pelted with a cell phone. She managed to dodge it. But, you know, I go to a lot of concerts. You love concerts. Like, I've never been to a Springsteen concert where I thought, let me hit him in the face with a cell phone and maybe he'll bring me on stage to sing Thunder Road with him, right? Like, what is wrong with these idiots? Stop throwing stuff on stage.
I agree. I don't know if these people think that somehow, you know, they're recording video and they'll get an interesting perspective of the artist. It's a great way to get their attention. I don't know. But, you know, they also put the artists in a terrible position, Rich, because, yes, these artists could get hurt seriously, but it's not a good look for them to be suing their fans. So the artists are put in a terrible predicament. I mean, they know that they really don't want to be suing their fans, but if they end up getting seriously injured, I think they absolutely should.
Ruth, if you go buy a new iPhone today, it's like $2,000, right? I mean, are you going to throw a $2,000 piece of equipment and never see it again? Because you think what the artist is going to be impressed or something? I don't get it.
Of course not. First of all, let's start with the point is for you to go viral and, you know, taking videos and pictures. Why would you then throw your phone to the artist? So it makes no sense. I agree. They're complete idiots. Pretty stupid thing to do. I don't get it. I mean, you obviously go to a concert to enjoy yourself and to have those memories by throwing yourself out. That's, you're done.
All right. We like Steve to end every show with our Around the Horn segment, going around and learning a little bit about everyone. We just talked about Luke Bryan, country singer. Do you have a favorite country artist of all time? Steve Borgstrom, start off. Who's your favorite?
Well, I did want to comment. I think I have a solution for that.
Oh, let's go.
Let's put a net around the entire stage of all performers anymore.
Not the Blues Brothers, field. Chicken wire.
Right.
Just like the Blues Brothers.
Class action suit.
Chicken wire. Like, not just Blues Brothers, but the Great Roadhouse movie. So, Steve, that's a good idea. Some artists are, by the way, putting up plastic partitions, which is ridiculous. But what about your favorite country artist of all time? Do you like the both kinds, country and Western?
Yeah, you know, and I actually met Luke. I didn't know who he was at the time in Hawaii a couple of years ago when he was performing in Honolulu. He came over to Maui. I thought he was a car salesman, but he was the nicest guy. Somebody told me after the fact who he was.
All right. Well, Steve is really going outside the box and picking the same person we just talked about as his favorite artist. Awesome. Ryan Burrow, do you have a favorite country artist of all time?
I saw Zach Brown Band, so I guess they led into Tom Petty one time. They're good, and I know they're very popular, so I'll go with them.
All right, awesome. Ruth Racinski.
I'm definitely not a country girl, so I cannot tell you which one is my favorite artist.
not even some of the contemporary. But what about Beyonce? Do you like Beyonce? Everyone loves Beyonce.
I mean, we want to go that route. We can say Texas Hold'em. So, yes, for sure.
You know, she's the biggest artist in the world right now.
Yeah.
Allow it.
All right. Tina, do you have a favorite country artist?
Johnny Cash.
Johnny Cash, the man in black. Can't go wrong with him. I'm going to choose the immortal Willie Nelson. I like myself some Willie. Can't go wrong with Willie. Leslie, Lisa, before we sign off, do you want to throw any names in the mix?
I like Blake Shelton.
Blake Shelton, whose wife is Gwen Stefani.
Gwen.
Very good. Well, those are good choices, Ryan. We'll see you all at the, what's the Chicago Country Festival again?
Country Thunder, right? Isn't that the big one up in Wisconsin?
That's right.
And yeah. I think Luke Bryant, by the way, is playing at Wrigley Field this summer.
By the way, speaking of country, did you see Tim McGraw the other day wearing the Caitlin Clark jersey? That guy is ripped, man. That guy was like jacked. He's wearing a Caitlin Clark jersey. I don't know if you saw that.
I'll put it on my to-do list. Thank you, Rich. All right. Well, thank you so much, Ruth Rosinsky and Steve Borgstrom. That'll do it for this latest installment of Legal Face-Off on WGN. Special thanks to Renato Stabile, an attorney and managing director at DRC, Andrew Brandt, professor of sports law at Villanova University, and attorney at Gloria Allred. Also, shouts out to Ben Anderson, Lisa Stegel. For Tina Martini, Rich Lenkoff, I'm Ryan Breaux. Thanks again for joining us on Legal Face-Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lenkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget...